everyone, and welcome to our episode of Coffee and Issues. My name is Carol Bernard, CEO and co-founder of Govology, and I'm joined by my trusty co-host, Mr. Michael Lejeune, managing partner of RSM Federal. And thanks, Michael, for being here again today. And then welcome back for our special guest, Mr. Stephen Coprince. So Stephen was with us last month, and Stephen is a faculty instructor and legal analyst here at Govology, retired attorney, founder of Prince McCall and Puttroff LLC. And Stephen's enjoying some retirement, but also doing some really great training and continuing to doing some blogging with us and some different appearances like the one today. So thank you for being with us, Stephen.
Glad to be here, Carol. Thanks for having me again. And thank you, Michael, as well.
This is our next episode of Coffee and Issues, where we're going to be talking about small disadvantaged business certifications, opportunities, and confusion. So on that note, what I would like to start off with is talking about what I consider to be some historic opportunities right now in the government marketplace, and not just the federal government, also state and local governments. I'll explain what I mean by that here in a second, but I'd like to give Michael and Stephen an opportunity also to chime in on this. And let's talk about some of the opportunities that you guys are seeing right now, both in general, but also specifically maybe for some of the small disadvantaged businesses that are out there. Michael.
I think it's interesting when I look around, and I think you were talking before the show about how the Navy had missed their goal by like $600 million last year. Mm-hmm. And I think on the one hand, it's pretty neat how the goals keep going up. But there's also, to me, part of the confusion is I think people think it's so easy to get a contract because you're a small business. And the government has so many standards and rules that even though they are increasing the goals, they're still trying to make sure that we have qualified small businesses, not just a small business or a hub zone or an 8A or whatever. Just because you've checked that box doesn't mean you can be relaxed on that other stuff. And so even though the opportunity is growing in the market, there's such a need to be qualified and prepared to do this.
Absolutely.
And that's probably my biggest comment on this whole thing is you've got to be prepared. Just checking that box is not going to get the job done, or else the government, such as the Navy and everybody else, they'd be exceeding their small business goals, and they're not. And so we have to be prepared on our end in order to help them meet their goals.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I would just build on that a little bit. It is, I think, an era of opportunity, especially for these small disadvantaged businesses. We're going to be talking about how the administration is wanting to push that goal all the way to 15% of federal prime contracting dollars. And so the goal for a long time was 5%. That's a little misleading because the government was doing 9-10% per year. But last year, right around 11%, something like that. So we're talking about a major increase if you actually get up to 15%. So that's going to present a lot of opportunities moving forward. But to sort of build on what Michael is saying here, when we talk about these goals and we talk about what it means to achieve these goals, we're always talking about dollars. We're talking about prime contracting dollars for the most part, specifically going to these companies. And there's a second piece of that that is not getting much attention. That is the fact that the number of small businesses in the federal marketplace continues to go down year over year, especially at DOD, but also at other agencies. And so what you have every year when you see the SBA giving the agencies A's for achieving their goals and A+ or whatever, it's because the dollars are going to these companies, but the pie is getting bigger and bigger, but it's getting divided into smaller and smaller pieces. And so I think there's a growing awareness on the part of the SBA and some in government that we can't just focus exclusively on the dollars. And as Michael said, getting folks ready to get, you know, procurement ready, as they say, to win those contracts is really important. And when you look at the flip side of the fact that the number of small businesses in the marketplace is actually going down, that tells you that we as a government contracting community, if we value kind of a diversity and a broad industrial base, as I think the government does, we got to focus not just on the dollars, because that's going to grow almost every year just based on budgets and inflation, et cetera, but how many folks are participating in the marketplace, and those who aren't participating, what tools are we going to provide? What resources are we going to provide to get them in a place where they can compete and win in this marketplace?
Absolutely.
The only thing I would add to that is, as you're talking about the company shrinking, we've been watching the contractor base shrink for years. Just years and years it's been shrinking. And given what's going on in the economy, I absolutely expect the contractor base to continue to shrink, because a lot of contractors are not solely in government. They have one leg in government, one leg in commercial. And even if they've been in government for a while, they're not necessarily fully engaged, winning successfully all the time, have a strategy, all that kind of stuff. And as the contractor base shrinks, that creates opportunity for the people that are left over, because someone has to step in, especially on those contracts that are going to come up for recompete, on new contracts that are going to roll out. And so you're going to see some opportunity in those areas. And I do see some people coming in and starting new businesses, but I don't think that rate is going to be as high right now over like probably the next 2 years-ish, probably. When we take a step back and look at the economy, it's probably going to be late 24 before we really see a resurgence of businesses coming out there. So it just depends, though. We saw some wild stuff happen in 2020 where people were like, I'm just going to start a company instead of going to work or worrying about COVID or any of that kind of stuff. So it's kind of all bets are off. It's just kind of a, hey, I think this is, if I had a crystal ball, I don't see as many people starting new companies over this 6 to 12 months. It's probably going to be closer to 18 to 24 months before people start companies. So there's just a lot of opportunity in that next 18 to 24 months for you to scoop in and get some of those contracts.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Michael. And one thing that I will add is that one of the big historic opportunities that I see is kind of a combination of a few things. For one, we already know that the federal government is the largest buyer of goods and services, spending about $600 billion each year now. On top of that, we saw a passage of a $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill, which we really haven't seen the effects of that just roll out just yet. But when we do see those projects, I see a lot of opportunity, not just on the federal side, but also on the state and local side, because a lot of those dollars are going to roll down to the individual state and local agencies to fund some of their infrastructure projects. So one of the things that I'm seeing, and this is why I wanted to come on here and talk about SDB today, because a lot of people don't know what it is. If you're not in the federal marketplace and you're out at like a government contracting, maybe a city event or a state government contracting conference, and you asked the whole room to raise their hands if they knew what that certification meant, probably a few hands would go up. But in reality, there's a lot of DBE firms, MBE firms, and MBE firms and others that might qualify for this SDB certification. So I want to really talk with Michael and Stephen about what that is today, eliminate some confusion, how that relates. But I think also there's a big opportunity here, Michael and Stephen, right now. Just like you said, that the facts are the facts. You know, one, you've got a moving target with agencies already missing their subcontracting goals for SDBs. At the same time, you've got all of this infrastructure spend and a decreasing contractor base, right? So that decreasing contractor base doesn't help the government meet some of those rising goals. And I think that there's a huge opportunity. And just like Michael said, you know, you got to really be prepared. And I always say the three tenets of procurement readiness are, number one, being business ready. Number two, being ready for the agency that you want to do business with, and then getting specifically ready for the opportunity. But I think there's a lot of opportunity right now for strong SDBs that might not even know that they're SDBs, that are not in the federal space, to come into the federal space and start participating in some of these contracts. Because I know a lot of times when some of those firms do come in, and we've seen it with some of our Govology clients, it's like when there's a well-qualified SDB and becomes an 8A firm, sometimes it goes gangbusters for those folks because they're like, yes, come here, you know, we need you. And so I see some opportunities there. So, but again, one of the things I see is the confusion. And people don't really know what the SDB certification even means, how that relates to other certifications like the federal 8A certification. And is there something on the state and local side that's similar? So, Stephen, I'm going to ask you to break it down for us and talking about, first of all, what is SDB and how does that relate to kind of some of all of the other certifications that are out there, both on the federal side as well as the state and local side?
Yeah, it is a confusing landscape out there because you got all these terms being thrown around, SDB, 8A, MBE, DBE, all this sort of stuff. That's just on the federal level. Then you get into the state and local governments, and they have programs, a lot of them that are use similar acronyms or somewhat different, but essentially are intended to do this the same sort of thing. And so my expertise is on the federal level. I can't really speak a whole lot to state and local because throughout the country and even an individual city or county may have a program that looks a little bit different. So I'll just talk about that at a big picture level. On the federal side, what you really have is a system in which you have, other than the Department of Transportation, which I'll get into briefly, but not a whole lot here, you've got the SDB, which is a self-certification. It stands for Small Disadvantaged Business, and that's a self-certification. And then you have 8A, and 8A is basically a certified SDB. And so we use the term all the time. But what those are small disadvantaged businesses that haven't self-certified. They've gotten the formal stamp of approval from the U.S. Small Business Administration. And that's where the rubber hits the road, because going back to the 90s, actually, there used to be contracts for self-certified SDBs, set-asides, that sort of thing. They don't exist anymore. And so the SDB self-certification, its primary value now is at the subcontracting level. And the large contractors have subcontracting goals, and those goals include a goal for SDB. And they can achieve that either by awarding contracts to 8As or to self-certified SDBs. Same thing on the prime contracting level. The government can get there by awarding contracts to 8As or SDBs, and so the self-certified SDBs. So the combination of the two is what they're trying to get to. The issue really is, and the confusion comes in, like, I have an SDB self-certification. They're increasing these goals. Isn't the government going to be throwing a bunch of contracts at me? And I'm a little bit skeptical about that. There is no legal mechanism for the government to award sole source contracts to self-certified SDBs, nor is there a legal mechanism to set aside competitions for self-certified SDBs. And so when the government is counting those self-certified contract awards toward its 15% goal or whatever it is now, 11% last year, 12% next year, they're getting there some other way, by using a small business set aside, by using an 8A set aside, by using a hub zone set aside, full and open. And then they look at the SAM profile. Oh, good, they're a self-certified SDB. Let's take credit for it. So there are a lot of folks that I've spoken with generally like, oh, great, I've checked out the SDB box and Sam, this is going to be great news for me. I'm not sure that it is. What I would offer is, if you are a self-certified SDB and you qualify, if you really truly qualify, then you should probably apply for 8A, unless you already had 8A. Why? Because when you look at the federal regulations, the SBA regulations as to what is an SDB, the answer is look at the 8A rules. That's literally what it says. It's a go look at the 8A rules. And so that's what it is. It's essentially an uncertified 8A. And that was different, and they've merged them together in a process ending in 2020. The eligibility requirements are essentially the same. And so if you legitimately qualify for it, then you should probably go get your 8A certification. Probably some companies out there, and I'm making it sound more dire maybe than it is, oh, you got to meet all the 8A criteria. But there are folks out there who may actually qualify for SDB/8A who don't think they do. And a lot of times those are, at the federal level, members of racial or ethnic minorities. And so there's a common misconception that if I'm not a minority, I'm out. That the 8A is a minorities only program. And that's not true. Being a member of certain groups such as African American, certain Asian American, and so on, can help you meet one of the eligibility criteria called social disadvantage, but it's not mandatory. I've worked with Caucasian women, Caucasian disabled people, others who are not minorities, and helped them get their companies in. And so it is one of those things that if you're looking at this increased goal as an opportunity, potentially saying, well, there are only 4,600 or so 8A firms out there. If the government's literally going to be trying to hit 15% and using 8A more and more, maybe my company could qualify, even if I'm not a minority, or even if I thought I had too much money and the test for income and net worth is a little bit more nuanced than folks think. So I think it's worth a second look if you might have kind of thought, nah, it didn't work, because in my state, you have to be a minority to get the certification, maybe. But at the federal level, you don't.
You just brought up another interesting thing that recently happened. I was talking to a small SDB, minority-owned business, veteran-owned business that's been doing a lot of work with the government. And I said, did you get your 8A certification? He's like, no, I think we've exceeded the standards. I was like, well, have you looked at them lately? Because they moved, right, Steve? The economic standards for getting in kind of moved up. So people that may have looked at it at one point should probably revisit where those are now, because they could find that they do now have eligibility for the 8A certification program, which has the social and the economic component together. But besides that, I wanted to go and recap something that you mentioned. And that is, like, with all of these certifications and the goals, the reason why you get certified is because that's what gives the agencies the best chance to ensure that they're meeting their SDB goals, and it helps them right? They could just award, they could tick the box if they make a SDB award that's like on a small business set aside, but they can't guarantee that they're going to have an SDB win when they do a small business set aside. But when they do an 8A set aside or an 8A sole source, every 8A is an SDB. So they're guaranteed to basically have an SDB that they're going to be able to tick the box to. But do you want to say something on the standards that I think they did raise, right, on some of the economic standards?
It's another thing. I'm glad you mentioned that. That's happened over the last couple of years. But there are two economic standards for SDB/8A because it is the same, where the SDB rules just say, look at 8A. So if you don't qualify for SDB, you also don't qualify for 8A, and probably vice versa too, other than a few minor things like if you're a graduated 8A, you can't get a second term, but you could still be SDB. But yeah, there's a net worth threshold, which is 70,000, but that's an adjusted threshold. And it used to be lower than that. Now it's 750. And I've had people say, well, that puts me out of the running in and of itself. And then a few of those people, I had to sort of explain what net worth means. They're like, they think it's an asset test, and it's not an asset test. It's an assets and liabilities. It's balance sheet. And then that 750 actually excludes the value in your primary residence, for example, excludes the equity in the business itself. And it's because your business ownership stake is worth something. And it excludes money in IRAs, 401k as well, traditional retirement accounts. And so a lot of people, they think they didn't qualify because they're either treating it as an asset test or they don't realize those exclusions exist. They actually do qualify. SBA doesn't want to penalize you for being a good retirement saver, for example. So that one, and then there's a $350,000 average annual income test as well. And that's a pretty high standard. If 3 years average, you're in one of the top income tax brackets. And even that has exceptions, such as a 1 year where you happen to get some one that made your income fluctuate for randomly. You won the lottery that year, did really well. You got a severance bonus from the job before you started your business, et cetera. So there are even exceptions on that front too. So it is the case that when we've gone through and run the numbers with some folks, we had people who meet the definition of millionaire. They do, but they still qualify for 8A because of the way their assets are distributed. But a lot of folks are closer than they think. And when we run the numbers, we found that, yeah, actually, you do slip below that 750. But yeah, if we can convince the SBA that that bonus you got that 1 year the company was going gangbusters is a one-time event, then your income would fall below.
Michael, you got anything to add?
Yeah, I think just to add some clarity here, I think when you look at the SDB, there's really two main criteria, and that is the ownership, the 51%, and the social plus economic disadvantage, those two. Mm-hmm. And then when you look at the 8A, it layers a third component in the size standard. And that's where you really come up with a lot of the 8A piece. The other big thing is, like, as an SDB, that's something you're most likely going to keep, whereas 8A is actually not a certification. It is a business development program. And I'm constantly trying to tell people, understand, just because you qualify for 8A does not mean you should go get 8A. You may not be ready for that yet. You need to have a plan. You need to make sure that you are actually winning contracts already, because the story that I get from 8As all the time is, hey, Mike, I'm in my third, fourth, fifth, seventh year, and we've never won a contract with this. What do we do now? And I'm like, well, there's not a lot left to do because you're almost done with the program, right? So that's why I'm always telling people, just because you qualify for 8A doesn't mean go get it. Make sure you have a plan. Make sure that you can see progress consistently in your business before you execute on that, because you can't stop that 9-year clock. That's the only thing about it. And so for me, those are the two distinctions. One of those, you're going to get it and keep it. The other one, you're going to get it and you're going to lose it at some point. Both really, really valuable. A lot of opportunity there. But it's understanding when to pull the trigger on the second one, which is that 8A, so that you can maximize that 9 years of it.
Absolutely. And I'm glad you brought that point up, because I have also seen 8A companies that are like in their ninth year without a contract. And so you definitely want to have a plan. And I wanted to make mention, because we've just launched a program here at Govology. We call it the Federal Procurement Readiness Acceleration Program. And we have a specific program for MBE and SDB firms, a track. And part of the goal there is to help you get into a structured path of training with some support. support so we can kind of get you ramped up quickly. So for example, if you know that your business ready and you're ready to go, I'll invite you to check out the cohort. We're taking applications right now. And one of the things that we're doing is we're trying to get funding to provide scholarships for SDBs and MBE firms that are coming into this program. So we might have full scholarships, we might have none, but I do encourage you to apply. And we have multiple cohorts right now, but let me give you the URL, govology.com/cohorts. And you'll see that Federal Procurement Readiness Acceleration Program, and specifically we have one for an MBE and an SDB track. Let me just go back because I saw a question that came in as we were talking about, like, what does actually self-certification as SDB entail? What that is simply, first of all, let me give you another link, govology.com/SDB. I just had a little article that I posted up there, and Stephen has just delivered to us a much lengthier and great explainer article that we're going to get posted on our website soon. But if you go to govology.com/SDB, the first place I would encourage you to start is read that article. And we've got three links there. What is a small disadvantaged business? And then it breaks down because the two components of that that must be met together are what is meant by socially disadvantaged and what is meant by economically disadvantaged. So if you go and read that law, and by the way, on the social disadvantaged piece, it's actually some sections from what qualifies for 8A certification, but the SBA has actually did a good job of going into some extra detail, and like what Stephen mentioned, while a lot of the minority-owned businesses would be able to get in under that presumed social disadvantage, read the language and what does it say? Essentially, the premise of it is, and Stephen, chime in if I say something inaccurate here, but the premise of this is that anytime you've received discrimination, bias, or unfair treatment, either in your work life or in your life as a business owner, you look at that and you kind of go back in time and think about your life and what were your struggles. And this is what the program is for, is for people who've had struggles in some of these areas based upon their individuality as a person or as a group. And so that's where some groups are recognized. If your group is not already a recognized group, there is actually a process to petition the SBA. I've seen some states that actually recognize an LGBTQ certification. And I've been asked in events, is there one for federal? I would say there's not one for federal, but this SDB and the 8A pathway may be a program for you. And it's on a case-by-case basis based upon the individual. So if you read those definitions there, and if you feel that it applies to you when you register at SAM, or if you are already registered at SAM, you can go and do an update. And question 17 in the representations and certification section of SAM says, are you a small disadvantaged business? And you could either say yes or no. That's self-certified. Now, if you want to take it to the step further and you've got a strong case to make and put it to the SBA, they will review it. And I think about the certification is like the SDB or the veteran zone is how's it been. Of course, it's changing because there was a self-certified, but then the VA were verifying. So basically, the SBA will verify you and certify you as an 8A program participant, and then you get to take advantage of sole source contracts with the federal government, 8A set-asides, and there's some other components that's very beneficial inside of what Michael mentioned, which was an 8A business development program for 9 years. So, by the way, there are certain years that if you were already certified, you had an extension year because they kind of gave a year for COVID. That's kind of over now. So, if you're applying today, you don't get the 10th year, but some of you might. So if you think that, hey, I'm almost at the end, I'm in my 9th year, if you were certified during COVID time, you might have that extra year tacked on. Go and look at your SBA profile and see what your ending date is on that. Michael, Stephen, you guys want to add something to that?
I have something to add. The social disadvantage, I think that is probably the most misunderstood piece of like how people qualify for it and where they disqualify themselves. So just to give a very quick example, we had a client who was a woman and she was in a state that most of the business owners are already men. So she was at that disadvantage. Then she decided to go into an industry that is like 90%+ men ownership in the construction space in her state. And she had multiple examples when it got to the write-up of how like she'd show up for a walkthrough and they're like, oh, where's your boss? Or like, hey, where's the owner? Or things like that happened to her. oh, hey, you were in the running, but we've never worked with a woman firm before, and that kind of got you disqualified. There were so many stories like that. It made it super easy for her to qualify for her 8A because of the disadvantage she's been at. So don't just automatically disqualify yourself from something like that because you're like, oh, well, I don't think I have anything that disqualifies me. Take a look at your background on the social side and see if there are some things. And on the flip side of that, just because you think you easily qualify for it, you're still going to have to come up with a narrative and describe that disadvantage. So you've got to kind of like go back in your life and think of, well, how was I at a social disadvantage? What are some of those examples like I just gave where we went through a walkthrough or something and something was pointed out to me or I was excluded because of whatever? You're going to have to write up that story. Yeah. And so those are just some points to think about on the social side.
Right. And even if you're a minority-owned business and fall within one of the presumed groups of social disadvantage, you still have to write up a disadvantage narrative, right, Stephen?
Actually, not anymore. They're changing these rules all the time. But yeah, I've worked also narratives that sound a lot like the one you're talking about there, Michael, with women. And so I do want to, for our audience, to make it clear there, really, when you're talking about 8A or SDB, and you're talking about the social disadvantage, which I agree is often the most misunderstood and often missed category there, there are really two subcategories within social disadvantage. Those who are members of groups that are presumed socially disadvantaged. And if you're a member of that group, unless SBA has reason to question that, then that's all you got to do these days is say, hey, I am a Black American. I am Asian American from certain countries that are listed in Asia that qualify. That's my ancestry. Now, I have had SBA reach out and say, basically, prove to us that you pulled yourself out to the world as Pakistani American. And so those sorts of things. So sometimes SBA will ask for more, but that's all you need to do. You don't need to write the narrative. You say, I'm a member of this group. If SBA wants more proof that you really hold yourself out and see yourself and society sees you as a member of that group, they will ask as part of the application process now. And there's a list. If you go to the regulation, there's just a list of the groups. And so you look at it and sometimes it's kind of, wait, so if I'm from Pakistan, I'm presumed. If I'm from Afghanistan, I'm not. Why is that? My answer is, I'm suspicious it's just political, right? That's my answer to that. But I don't know that for sure. But if you're not in one of those groups, then you're in a situation where, as Michael said, you're not necessarily out of the running, but now you got to prove that you personally experienced this bias or discrimination based on a distinguishing characteristic about you. A characteristic that might be your gender is probably the most common one, as Michael was talking about there. Woman, it's typically going to be a woman. I suppose it would also work for a man in a woman's field, maybe. But I haven't seen that one. It could be religion. It could be a physical or mental disability. You know, maybe LGBTQ status. We've seen those applications now. Some sort of distinguishing characteristic about you. And then you have to explain, this is again for the 8A application, how you have experienced bias or discrimination based on that characteristic and that the result of that bias or discrimination had an adverse impact on you, some sort of concrete adverse impact on you, either in your education, in your career, when you're working for somebody else, or in your business, as Michael was talking about with folks who said, where's the boss and stuff like that. Those are jobs you're not getting. So that's an adverse impact, concrete effect on you. You know, and we're working with clients on this, or I was, I don't do this anymore, but when I did over the years, it's so commonly misunderstood that what the SBA is looking for is just a sob story. Like, here's everything bad that happened to me in my life. And I have gotten some really heart-rendering drafts from clients, like about their divorce and about how they had alcoholic parents and all this sort of stuff. And it doesn't matter because to SBA, I mean, it matters to you personally because these are tough things that you've overcome and it's part of your story, but had nothing to do with your distinguishing characteristic. Your parents' alcoholism wasn't because you were a female. So it's irrelevant to SBA. So I say usually with those things, let's tell that in a paragraph just so SBA can understand they're humans too, where you came from. But now let's think about times that you were discriminated against based on that characteristic. The final piece I'll mention on that is SBA understands that you don't have to prove that beyond a reasonable doubt. Most people, not everybody, but most people in this day and age are savvy enough not to say, hey, I'm not giving you this job because I don't like women-owned businesses. Now, some people might say that or at least imply it, but what you can do is, you know, if you say, look, I was the only women-owned business who bid. There are five other bids. My bid was $100,000 lower. We had the same sort of qualifications. They still awarded the male-owned company. That's probably going to be good enough for SBA, circumstantial evidence. What SBA is looking for is more likely than not that the reason was discrimination. We've seen this too where women, it's my most common example, they were passed over for promotion versus a less qualified man. Well, the boss didn't come in and say, we just want a man in the job, because most people are savvy enough not to do that in this day and age. But circumstantially, there was no real reason why he got passed over for somebody who was less qualified. So SBA will accept those as evidence because it's more likely than not a discriminatory reason in that case.
And it's not a court of law, like you're saying there, Stephen, to kind of back that up. It's not a court of law. So, you know, they're not going to sit there and, most of the time grill you 38 ways on this thing. They're just looking for the story for you to write it up. And I think the biggest part of it is you have to be able to articulate that. And that is a challenge in everybody's business that I see, whether it's your marketing, whether it's your capability statement, your website, is being able to articulate something very clearly, not just say, I was at a party once and I was discriminated against. Okay, elaborate on that a little bit. So you were talking about the write-ups there, being able to actually write two or three paragraphs on the incident and probably have two to three incidents within the last 5 to 10 years, you know, something fairly reasonable in order to build your case. But again, it's not a legal case in a court of law or anything like that. It's just to communicate to that other person on the other end what happened and how it affected you. And so that's kind of the thing that I look for in there is really simple. What happened? How did it make you feel? And how did it affect you, whether it was financially or some other way? How did it impact you? And if you can cover those three things in your two or three paragraphs, you're going to have a pretty good story to tell and likely get your certification.
Stephen, thanks, Mike. That brings me to a good statement that was actually made in the chat. We've had some great statements and questions coming in through the chat. And the last one says, the regulation states that an individual must prove by preponderance of evidence the discriminating factor. So, yep. Stephen, what the heck is a preponderance of evidence? And do we have to present like Exhibit A? Here's, you know, what happened here in a court of law.
Yeah.
How far do people have to go to basically substantiate their claim?
So the preponderance of the evidence is essentially the legalistic term for the term I used when I was talking, which is more likely than not. That's what preponderance of the evidence means as a legal term. There are different standards in the law as to how much weight you have to prove a case. As we all kind of know from watching television drama, the standard in a criminal case is, you know, proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's a much higher standard than preponderance of the evidence, which is literally more likely than not. And you can get even lower than that. Reasonable suspicion essentially is what the cops, the police officers need to have to pull you over. They don't need to even say it's more likely than not that you're breaking the law, just they have a reasonable, you know, probable cause to pull you over. And that's less than 50%, but more than zero, essentially. So the SBA, in this sense, is looking for that 51%. They want more likely than not that you experience discrimination. And it's a good point that you made there, Carol. They do not expect you to prove that with third-party evidence. They will take your sworn statement, and you should submit it to SBA under penalty of law. It doesn't have to be notarized or anything, though you could certainly do that. And they will take that as a sworn statement under penalty of law that the events happen as you lay them out. And unless they have contradictory evidence or what you say makes no sense, it's illogical, they will accept that. Now, you can back that up with witness statements and such. I've done that with clients who say, yeah, my colleague knew this happened at the time. You know, he saw it, she saw it, whatever. Great. That makes your case even stronger. There's no reason not to do that, but it's not expected. A lot of the discrimination happens in one-on-one conversations, in fact. You know, I sat down with my boss and he said, yeah, your colleague is getting more money because he has a family to support, because it's this sexist idea that a man has to support the family, right? And so no one else is in the room there. If you ask the boss is like, I didn't say that. I would never say that, right? So they'll take your word for it as the applicant, unless, again, it's illogical, makes no sense, or it's internally contradictory. But you can submit additional evidence, and I've certainly done that. If there's more evidence available, by all means, do it. It just makes your case stronger. It's not expected, not required.
Awesome. I want to circle back for a second and just going back to the confusion. So like if you are a state or local type of contractor, what certifications kind of might carry over to equate to an SDB? When I think about it, first and foremost, DBE certification on the state and local side. If you met the DBE criteria, you're probably going to qualify on the SDB side. MBE. If you get certified as an MBE at the state and local side, you may qualify as an SDB, but you also need to be underneath those economic size standards. If you're above them, probably wouldn't qualify because there's both of the components, social and economic. Women-owned businesses. Again, women-owned businesses are not part of a presumed group that has a social disadvantage, so you would make the case for it based upon your individual circumstances, but that's another one. So there is a WOSB certification that you could get on the federal side, but you should also take a look at the SDB language. And if you can make a case for it, the first thing that I would suggest if anybody is actually doing a self-certification is go ahead and tick the box and then write up your disadvantaged narrative. Even if you're not going for the 8A, what if you get a question and a contracting officer says, well, show me that you are, because if I'm going to tick this box, I want to make sure. It probably doesn't happen a lot out there, but at least you've got some documentation for yourself if you've ever get asked. But also, Stephen, there's a proposed rule right now that would allow for a protest of an SDB. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, and I think it's important to say, yeah, if you're self-certifying as SDB, and Michael's right. I mean, I certainly didn't mean to say, hey, if you're eligible for 8A, you absolutely should apply now. You got to be ready for it. I've had those clients too who, you know, are like, hey, we're in our fifth year and finally we know what to do with this 8A. So if you're SDB, think you're SDB, this may be a good time to get 8A, but you got to be ready to handle that 9-year period. It goes by quicker than you think. But I would caution that when you go to SAM, one of the things that the SAM says is you certify that you have represent certs, including the question 17, the SDB status is current, accurate, and complete, and that you have read all the underlying rules, so that you're telling the government that you understand the criteria. And so that is the expectation that's moving forward. Now, it is true that because the SDB status does not really convey any prime contracting benefits, particularly right now, there's no set-asides and sole sources, it's mostly used for subcontracting purposes, the government has not been doing a lot of enforcement on who qualifies as an SDB. I expect, if pulling out my crystal ball, I think that's going to change. I think it's going to change for two reasons. I think first, as we push toward 15%, and we're trying to get 15%, which is a huge number of dollars, to this category of businesses, at some point, some enterprising congressperson probably is going to be like, hey, let's take a look at whether all the businesses that are counted toward this status actually qualify. Like, if you know, if we're saying that, you know, half of our SDB goal was met through self-certified companies, how do we even know that's true? How do we know they're eligible? And so I expect you're probably going to see agency inspector general offices and or the GAO, which in addition to bid protests does a lot of audits and investigations. I expect that at some point we're going to have those sorts of things done on kind of a broad swath, a representative sample of self-certified SDBs. And my guess is that we're going to find that, I mean, I'm just guessing, I bet half of them aren't eligible. That's my guess. And that's been true when they've done the similar audits on self-certified SDVOSBs, for example, self-certified woman-owned small businesses, right, back when that was a thing, and the woman-owned small business self-certification. That's just my guess. I don't know that, but I think they will find that. And of course, the businesses that are found to be non-compliant could be on the hook for various penalties. And then as you mentioned, Carol, SBA 2 months ago has proposed a pretty broad suite of new rules, which we discussed in our last Coffee and Issues podcast. And one of them is this notion of protests of an individual's SDB status. There's not a mechanism right now for anybody to protest an SDB to the SBA and have the SBA do a review of that. SBA is proposing to allow that. Right now, competitors wouldn't be doing it, but it would be contracting officers primarily who would now have a vehicle. If they see a company that's SDB and they're like, you know, I don't know. Like the owner of that company, they're not a minority. They seem like they're driving around Lamborghini. I'm not so sure this is an SDB. They can now just, once this rule goes final, which I expect it will next year, probably, they'll be able to just bring that to SBA and say, SBA, can you just take a look at this company and see if they really qualify? And if you don't, again, you could be on the hook for things like False Claims Act penalties, even suspension or debarment. I mean, the government has a lot of tools at its disposal there, but it's not going to be good. And I don't want to scare anyone off, because yeah, I think if you make a good faith effort to comply, you're unlikely to be penalized all that much in a setting like this. But if you literally had no clue what the underlying rules meant, you didn't abide by the instruction to research your eligibility, you have no basis to say you're socially disadvantaged. As Carol was mentioning, well, I don't know, I'm a distinguishing characteristic. I'm really good looking and people don't like that about me. You want to be able to answer the question if it's asked, because at some point it's going to probably be asked. And that also puts you in a position where when it is time for you to apply to 8A, whether that's right away or whether that's a few years from now, that you've already answer those questions. You have a much stronger 8A application ready to go.
And that's why I had suggested, again, go to where we posted the blog, govology.com/SDB. Open up those links, read the language. If you feel like you meet the criteria, write down your own social disadvantage, because it may be a couple of years, like Michael mentioned, before you even want to apply for 8A, because it's a 9-year business development program for verified and certified SDB firms. And it's unlike the other certifications which I do encourage you to go out and get, like DBE, MBE on the state and local side, WBE, WOSB, SDVOSB. All of these certifications don't really have a time limit per se. So if you are one of those businesses, you got it. But it does have a time limit inside of the certified 8A business development program. So the other case that I would say too is just like, I think that having some documentation would help to reduce some of that fear, because I think some people are afraid to check the box because it's like, oh, if there's an audit or if there's a protest, they're going to come after me. But I really think that there are two things that typically happen, and Stephen, and please comment on this. But one thing is that there's people that will legitimately say, I believe that I do meet this. I'm going to write up my social disadvantage. If there's an audit or something and somebody says, you're actually not, you're probably not going to be penalized and go to jail. As opposed to the situations that we saw where people were self-certifying as a service-disabled veteran-owned small business, and they weren't even a veteran. That's straight-up fraud. Can you talk about those two aspects to help to reduce some fear of people that might be scared of ticking the box?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you hit the nail on the head there. And it's both on the legal side and just on the how is the government, SBA, or whichever agency is looking at this is, you know, reasonable about this too. And so the rule says you need to review the underlying regulations and essentially do your due diligence and believe in good faith that you qualify. I mean, and when it comes to something like a social disadvantage narrative, there's some subjectivity there. You know, there's going to be elements of subjectivity. And so you could say, look, I really think that these 3-4 instances I had, I'm a woman, or you know, I've got this disability, or I've got this other characteristic, and these bad things happened, and I think it was a result. It could be that when you apply to 8A, the SBA is like, nah, we're just not buying that. But it was reasonable. I mean, you had a reasonable basis to check that box. Reasonable minds can differ on that. And I doubt that you're going to come up with any penalties probably at all at that situation. If anything, it wouldn't be that bad because you in good faith repped inserted what you thought was true. And for those who are thinking on the legalistic side, False Claims Act is one of the most likely penalties that folks would face from an incorrect certification. But the False Claims Act does have what the lawyers like to call a mens rea component. That means state of mind. And so for a False Claims Act case to proceed against you, for the government to prevail on that, then the government has to show that you either knew the certification was fraudulent or you acted in reckless disregard to the facts. And that I think would mean I didn't look at the rules at all. I had no idea. I just checked the box because I felt disadvantaged. You know, I'm a minority, so I checked it even though my name's LeBron James and I'm not economically disadvantaged, right? And so if you're in that situation and you just didn't do your due diligence, you had no idea what the criteria were, that may be a False Claims Act situation because you act in reckless disregard of the truth. But if you did your investigation and you just arrived at a result that, while reasonable, is not the same result that somebody else would have resolved, that's not a False Claims Act case because there's the state of mind component is not there. So that is probably the most likely sanction you would face. That takes that off the table because they have not shown that mens rea component.
You mentioned subjectivity. Is it possible that when somebody turns in an 8A application and they do have to write the social disadvantage narrative to it, is there some subjectivity by the person that might be reviewing it? Could one person who is reviewing be different from the next? And then you've got the Office of Hearing and Appeals. So there's not like an end if you do get a denial on your social disadvantage, right?
Yeah, there absolutely is. There's a human element to it. And I'm sure Michael would say the same when he's right. If you're doing a couple things, you're trying to hit a checklist of I've got this distinguishing characteristic. I had this incident that happened. I'm going to tie it. It was bad. Here's why I think, you know, more than likely or not, it was tied to my distinguishing characteristic. And here's the adverse effect it had on me. So you're trying to hit those bullet points in each incident, but you're also trying to tell a story because the person reading it is a human being. And you're a human being, and you're trying to tell a story that makes them feel some empathy for you as well and understand the sort of things you went through. And I can't quantify that, and I'm sure SBA would say we try to, you know, make it as objective as we possibly can. But I don't think that that's possible because everybody's story is different. Everybody's story is different. And so one person can look at it as a specific incident and say, yeah, that meets the test. And I think someone else might say, no, I don't think that was more likely than not discrimination, or I don't think you tied it closely enough to your distinguishing characteristic. Maybe you were just bad performer on the job, whatever. Fortunately, you did mention the SBA Office of Hearings and Appeals, and that is the administrative judges within SBA who can hear appeals. If you're denied from the 8A program based on a lack of social disadvantage or some other criteria, not all reasons, but if you're denied based on SBA found you don't have social disadvantage, you can actually take that to the administrative judges and they will review it. And over the years, the judges have done a pretty good job of holding SBA's feet to the fire when it has gone a little too far in the direction of excluding people for no good reason. For example, SBA's judges have said, SBA, you can't invent hypothetical reasons why it wasn't discrimination. In other words, if the answer is, well, yeah, you said you were in this meeting and you were passed over for promotion versus a man who is not as well qualified, the SBA can't just say, yeah, but you might have been a lazy person. So they can't just invent stuff. And so various reviewers have sort of done that. They've come up with hypothetical reasons that have nothing to do with what you said, why your boss might have acted a certain way, or why Michael's example, you didn't get the contract. Well, it wasn't because you weren't a woman-owned business. It's because, you know, some other hypothetical reason. They didn't like the car you drove up in, whatever. It doesn't matter. And so the judges have done a pretty good job of holding SBA's feet to the fire. My experience, the SBA over my career, starting 16, 17 years ago, working on this up to the present, has gotten better. They've gotten more professional about their internal reviews, I think in part because they've been held to the fire, but also because of some better leadership that happened at SBA over time in that 8A program that has made it more likely that the SBA is not going to come up with ridiculous reasons to find your narrative not good enough.
Yeah, thank you for that explanation. It was great. Michael, do you have any final words that you'd like to impart before we probably close it out, and then we'll go into our Q&A session?
Yeah, we're actually probably running in our Q&A session. You know, I really have one final thought. You know, we've talked about a lot of the legal aspects and the challenges you may face and things like that, and it all needed to be covered. It's all stuff that needed to be covered. One thing we really didn't talk a lot today about was utilizing the certification to take advantage of the contract opportunities that are out there. And I'm just going to leave you with one point today. I can't for the life of me figure out why so many companies go through the trouble to get their certification and then never speak to the Office of Small Business Utilization. So that OSDBU is out there to be a resource for you, to help open doors for you. Any small business office is out there for you, but that one specifically is out there for you to be a resource. And it should be one of the first stops you make when you're trying to approach a new agency. They all have one. And so that should be the first stop, to get to know who those people are, to do a capabilities brief with those people. And anytime you're having challenges, copy them on emails to contracting officers when you're not getting responses and things like that. Make them do their job. And their job is to help be an advocate for you, to meet people that will eventually be awarding contracts, as well as to deal with challenges that you have. So don't feel like, hey, they're just more government and they're not helpful, so I'm not going to reach out to them. Make them do their job. Call those offices, build a relationship with them. Because that, again, it's often the entry point into an agency is that OSDBU office. So.
Hey, that was a great something to leave off with, because that's so important. Because, you know, when you get registered as SAM or you get a certification, you know, the contracts don't automatically start flowing into you. You know, you got to do some work. You got to be proactive to go out there and build some relationships and go out there and get it. And the OSDBU is a great place. As I mentioned, a lot of these agencies are missing their small business goals. Their OSDBU folks are the ones that are primarily tasked with ensuring that their goals are being met. In fact, at the highest levels in DC, there's bonuses that's tied to the SES position, OSDBU. So they're very interested. So if you come into an OSDBU and they've just missed their goal by millions of dollars or hundreds of millions of dollars, and you're well qualified and you're certified and all of that stuff, I think that you're going to get actually maybe an elevated level of attention that you might not have gotten 2 years ago when the goal was only at 5% and they were meeting it by, you know, hitting 10%. So I think that there's some new opportunities there. So I'm going to leave it at that. Thank you, everyone, for joining us for this episode. I want to put out three takeaways from this. Number one, again, if you came in late, I put a blog posting. It's at govology.com/SDB. If you want to find out if you qualify for SDB, go and open up the links, read the language of the law there. Number two, we also have a cohort program that's going to launch in 2023. And we have a specific track for MBE and SDB firms called the Federal Procurement Readiness Accelerator. So go to govology.com/cohorts if you want to find out more about that and apply. And then last but not least, mentioned this at the beginning of the show, but if you happen to have any questions that pop up and maybe we didn't get to them here or they just pop up later. Gavology Nation is our private LinkedIn group where you can join us for free. And I've got over 1,300 members, including Michael and Stephen, who is here today. So if you have a question that you want to pop into the group, and the best way to find our LinkedIn group is just to go to gavology.com/nation. And we have a little redirect set up there. So that concludes our show for today. Thank you, Michael and Stephen, for joining us. And we'll see you on the next episode. Now we're going to go into our Q&A session. By the way, if you guys want to ask a question live, just use that little raise your hand button and we can kind of unmute you and you can come on live with us. So let's see. Who should we speak with to see if we are ready to apply for an 8A program? Well, I would say a good place to start, if you aren't already tied in with your local PTAC, the Procurement Technical Assistance Program, it's a program that's funded by, in part, by the Department of Defense, along with co-hosts throughout the nation, various nonprofits and universities. We have some PTAC folks on the line here with us today. So if you want to find a local PTAC in your area, you can get free assistance, not only to determine if you are ready for 8A, but they can also help you with your certification and kind of help you walk through some of that stuff. So to find a PTAC in your area, go to www.aptac-us.org. Also, Minority Business Development Agency, there's an MBDA center. It's part of a government agency, but also there are many MBDA local centers around the United States. So go to mbda.gov. I would encourage you to tie in with your local center. They also do a lot of work with MBEs in helping you secure your foundation. But part of what they do is to help to ramp up MBE firms for procurement opportunities with the government. So check them out. There's a few other ones out there, but do you have any other thoughts on that one, Stephen?
Yeah, that's absolutely where I'd start. You know, when I was in my career as a lawyer, we were kind of a paid resource. And I'd always tell people, look, you know, start with the free resources. And a lot of times that's all you need. PTAC's where I would start. They're wonderful. Sometimes the help you need, like rewriting your narrative, is beyond what the PTAC's going to do for you. They're able to do. And then that's when you would maybe reach out to someone like a government contracts attorney or something like that. But the PTAC's great because they can help you both with two sides of it. One, are you eligible? And if not, how do you get there? And maybe they would say, talk to a lawyer about redoing your operating agreement or something, but they can at least help you understand where the holes may be. And then second, as Michael brought up, what is your plan here? You know, what's the business readiness for using that 8A certification? So are you ready both on the legal side, eligibility side, and are we have a plan to take advantage of this for the full 9-year period side? And if not, let's get where you need to go on both of those sides, if at all possible.
Yeah, absolutely. But another question that came in, and this is related to the cohort programs that I was talking about at gavology.com/cohorts. I mentioned our Federal Procurement Readiness Accelerator program. And so somebody said, I see the Procurement Readiness Bootcamp for veterans, which we do have that as well. And they were asking if the program is only for veterans. So that's going to be the first box that you're going to see when you go to that link. The second box down that you're going to see is the Federal Procurement Readiness Program, SDB and MBE track. So if you want to jump into that track, that's the one you would want to apply to. And we'll be talking about some specifics as it relates to the SDB and the MBE community in that particular track. Will we get a copy of the recording? So we are recording this. Where we post that recording is on our website at gavology.com/issues. So in addition to this session, which will be posted on our website at that URL, you can also go back and see some of our previous issues that we've discussed. Okay. One question, are women presumed socially disadvantaged? No, you do have to make the case for it. And we've also seen this, Stephen, and I think there was some talk a while back about perhaps making all service disabled veterans socially disadvantaged. And I think there was some push for that. And then the SBA actually, I think, took a look at it one time and they said, well, no, but if a SDVOSB firm wants to make a case for it, they can make a case for it on an individual basis. Because there could be a cause where your disability leads to some challenges that could cause you social disadvantage, but maybe not, right? So maybe your disability has not caused you a social disadvantage. So that's where the SBA probably said, well, let's look at this on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah, and that's exactly how it's worked. And so, again, women, you can certainly argue that they should be at least in industries, if not all, presumption of disadvantage for women, but there's not currently. So you do have to show that individually you've experienced bias or discrimination, like we're talking about with the narrative. Same with disability, whether or not you're a veteran. And so that is, to be clear, you can show social disadvantage based on a physical or mental, regardless of whether that disability came about due to a service-connected reason. And I would also point out that some cases, mental disability will qualify as well. For example, PTSD. We've had clients with PTSD that I've worked with who were able to show that that disability, even though it's not evident to someone at first glance, with that person became aware of that disability, they treated them in a discriminatory way. But then again, that person had to show his or her individual social disadvantage. So 13 CFR, I'm going to give you a regulation to look at just so people can go see. 13 CFR, when you hear 13 CFR, that means SBA regulations. CFR simply stands for Code of Federal Regulations. So if you plug this into your favorite web browser or web Google or whatever search engine, 13 CFR 124.103, 13 CFR 124.103B. What is that? That is the list of everybody who's presumed disadvantaged. And so it starts with Black Americans, Hispanic Americans, Native Americans, and then literally starts going through a list of Asian Americans from various countries. And it has a list of, you know, a dozen or more countries. So not every Asian American would qualify, would you have to be from certain countries. And that's the list. And so if you're a member of one of those groups, then you're presumed socially disadvantaged. If you're not, that doesn't mean that you don't qualify. It means that now you have to point out what your distinguishing characteristic is and explain how that led to bias or discrimination.
Yeah, and those links to that reference law that Stephen just talked about, again, govology.com/SDB. I have links directly to the law that says what is a socially disadvantaged business, what is economically disadvantaged, which was also the next question was like, you know, is there an income threshold for qualification to 8A? Yes, there is. So go and take a look at the law. And Stephen mentioned earlier too that there's some other economics that take place in it. But when you look at the law, there's also some exclusions. So you might want to kind of on the edge of that, you might want to look at what are the exclusions for like income, net worth, and total value of assets.
Yeah, that's right. And that is 13 CFR. I'm sure Carol has this link too, 13 CFR 124.104. So you can go read it and understand not only what those thresholds are. For example, income is a three-year average of $350,000. But as I mentioned, there are certain exclusions from that. And even when you hit that threshold, it's a presumption that you aren't economically disadvantaged. And you were able to rebut that presumption and by showing, again, like your income in 1 year was just really unusually high for some reason that won't repeat, or that you had business losses that ate up a good chunk of that. So there are ways to potentially even explain an income that's higher than that. So take a look at the rule. I know I hate to say people go read regulations, but this is one of those ones where to truly understand it, you want to actually read the rule for yourself. And you don't need a lawyer to do this. You know, they're written so that person of good intelligence, adult of good intelligence can understand them, I think. You can always ask follow-up questions, but that's the place to start. Read the rule for yourself and then discuss that with your PTAC counselor or whoever's advising you on this process.
Stephen, is it proper to state that in SAM.gov, an individual is self-designating themselves as an SDB and not certifying themselves?
Well, I don't know that you need to, the terminology matters so much. What I would say is self-certifying, because what you're certifying to in SAM is to the business. You're saying, does the business qualify as a small disadvantaged business? In so doing, you are also essentially certifying or designating however, whatever terminology you want to use, that the majority owner of that business is a disadvantaged individual, because that's one of the criteria. But I use the term self-certification. I think that's what the SBA would say too, keeping in mind that this comes under the portion of SAM expressly called representations and certification. So I look at that as a self-certification. The business is the one doing the certifying. It is certifying to its own status. In so doing, it is making representations, implied representations, about the owner, the majority owner, owners of that business in terms of their social disadvantage, their economic disadvantage, et cetera.
Awesome. I had a great question when they came in, Stephen. This one I've never really considered just yet, but is there a category for seniors?
Disadvantage category, no, but I again think that would be one of those ones where
case by case basis,
because that is a distinguishing characteristic about you. And as many people would attest, there is ageism in this society. In fact, there's the age discrimination laws out there that would prohibit employers who are fall under those laws from discriminating against older employees. And so those rules were adopted for a reason, because discrimination against older individuals does happen. So yeah, that would be a case by case. It's not a presumed category. I've never worked on an application like that, but I see absolutely no reason why you couldn't say, hey, you know, I was treated this way because things were going great. And when I showed up and they saw that I was, you know, X age, I was older than my competitors, they treated me differently. You know, that those sorts of things. So yeah, absolutely.
What's that movie with Robert De Niro? He went back to the workforce after he retired.
That was a good movie though. And it happens. It happens. You know, I've known people who've had that where they've been, you know, forced out of jobs and, you know, things like that because of ageism. So yeah, it's not a presumed category, but it's absolutely one that had it popped up when I was working with people on these applications and someone had a document, could document incidents. I would say, yeah, let's give it a shot, because that there's no reason that couldn't qualify.
Is discrimination for being a declared primary caregiver for a disabled family member a reasonable criteria?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. And unfortunately, I need to know more about that. There's no limit under the rule, really, as to what can qualify as a distinguishing characteristic. No limit that would exclude that anyway. You want to follow up with that and see what that means, though. Because, you know, does it mean that people just didn't want to hire you, or, for example, because you had that role? Or did it mean that because you had that role, you couldn't fulfill the job the same way that someone who didn't have that role has? In other words, your availability was less than somebody else's, for example. Because I think SBA would look at the latter situation and say, well, that's not discrimination. That's them needing someone who works a certain schedule and you weren't available. If, on the other hand, you could have met that schedule, but they were just concerned when they saw that you wouldn't, even though you promised you would, then maybe. That was my intake call with you back when I was a lawyer and having a half-hour intake conversation. Those are the sorts of things I'd want to unwrap, and that would be a good one to sit down with your PTAC or whoever's advising you on these issues and kind of get to the heart of whether this discrimination was unfair discrimination. In other words, you were equally capable or better qualified than somebody else and they treated you differently anyway, or whether it was differing treatment because you couldn't do the same role as somebody else because of your other obligation. That's a different situation potentially in the discrimination world.
Absolutely. Well, Stephen, I think we've got through all the questions. The rest of what I see in the chat are just really nice comments from everybody. So thank you, everyone, for the nice comments. And I'm glad that, you know, we could contribute some value and maybe kind of reduce some of the confusion that's out there. So, and Stephen, again, as always, it's such a pleasure to have you join us on these things. It's like so valuable, all your information and also for keeping me honest.
Well, there's so much going on in there. And, you know, even that issue with the disadvantage narrative, SBA required that for a while. And then eventually was like, well, why are we doing this? We already require so much paperwork. You're presumed. Why do we even care? You know, so, and that was smart. And they used to require these economic disadvantage narratives too. Like, even though you met the net worth and income thresholds, you still had to sort of write out why you were economically disadvantaged. And eventually they said, well, why are we doing this? Well, all we're doing is looking at the net worth and income, you know? So they've made some positive steps over the years, but that just, you know, reflects that these are, they're ongoing, they're living, breathing rules, and the SBA does come in and tweak them from time to time. And at some point, some of the stuff we're talking about today will be outdated too. But for right now, hopefully this was, based on the comments, a good overview for the folks who are joining us.
Yeah, I'll just share one story before I leave. And I think that'll maybe provide a good tip for anybody that's not a part of the, you know, presumed disadvantaged groups in writing up their narrative. I used to work for the SBA. I was an 8A business opportunity specialist / business development specialist out of the Portland District office. And by the way, if you are going for 8A certification, that's another resource that can help you, your local 8A business opportunity specialist. So look up and have a conversation with them, because at our office and my predecessor, you know, as I was, he was mentoring me as an 8A BOS. I would look at what he would do with some of the companies. Now, he was kind of above and beyond maybe what some people will get from most SBA offices, because he was like a single gentleman and he would stay up till like 11 p.m. at night just working for the pure pleasure of it. But when there was the time when even the minority-owned businesses had to do the disadvantaged narrative, those things were very detailed. He would go into like starting when they were a child and maybe they immigrated into the country, and he would like put pictures of them, and it was like very detailed. So if you are in one of those groups that don't have the presumed disadvantage and you want to go after 8A certification, document your life. Look at everything that's occurred and think through. It's like, you know, when have been times if you've received discrimination, unequal treatment based upon your gender or whatever that may be. Maybe you're a senior. Maybe you are LGBTQ community and you've received discrimination. Want to like really document it well, because you're making the case for yourself to somebody on the other end that is looking at this and making their determination whether it was like a substantial enough to get you approved. So again, that's it, Stephen, I think. Thank you again.
Yeah, thanks for having me as always, Carol. It's always a lot of fun, and glad so many folks could join us for this one. Look forward to the next one.
All right. Thank you. And thank you, everyone. We'll see you soon. Take care. And happy Bye-bye. Thanksgiving if we don't get to see you guys before Christmas time rolls around.
Absolutely. Best wishes for the holidays for those who won't see before then.
I can't believe it's here already.
I know. Crazy, right? Look, November. You got to be kidding me. But see you soon,
right,
Carol.
Take care.
Yep. Bye-bye.